This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As college students pack up the car and head to campus, their excitement may be tempered by the hard reality of how to pay for it all. While the high cost of higher ed has been a major concern for years now, tuition and other college-related expenses still seem on an ever-rising path. But before despair sets in, experts say take heart and do your homework. There may be more options for trimming those bills than you realize. Today in The Exchange, how to go to college without going into massive debt. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests with me in studio. Brendan Barnard, Director of College Counseling for the Dairy Field School. He also writes on the college admissions process for the Washington Post, the Huffington Post, and the Concord Monitor. And Brennan, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Rich Nielsen, Education Loan Program Manager with the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation, known as the NEAF Network. And Rich, good to see you. Thank you for being
here. Good
morning. Also joining us by phone from D.C., Goldie Blumenstick, Senior Writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education and author of the book American Higher Education in Crisis, What Everyone Needs to Know. And Goldie, welcome back to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, and Brennan, before we get into the loans and the grants and the scholarships and so forth, how do you hear students and their families weighing their college hopes and dreams versus those tough fiscal realities?
You know, we really, Laura, we really encourage students and families to start as kind of early and often, you know, as often as possible, to talk about the realities of going to college and the costs, and really having that conversation up front. I have a colleague who likes to explain it kind of in the car buying analogy, right? So if you're going to go buy a car, you're not going to identify all the amazing features you want and the sunroof and the you know, the all the amenities, and then get there and realize you can't afford it, right? You're going to kind of set your price range. You're going to talk about that up front, and then you're going to go out. So you don't end up just looking at Lamborghinis and Audis, and that's what you end up with. And all you can afford is, I don't know, a Volkswagen.
Right? Is that how people do it, Brennan, right now? The first scenario that you painted, they say, oh, I want this and this and this and this, and then they focus on the money?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's what we've been encouraging for a long time, is for students to really identify what they, you know, what they love and what they want to do and what their ideal would be and what, you know, what does their ideal college experience look like. And for students who, for, you know, families with that financial issues are going to be, you know, a main part of the decision, that's really difficult, because then they get to senior spring and they're faced with a bunch of schools they can't afford. And so having those conversations up front is just so important.
It's kind of a tub of cold water, though, Goldie, huh? On a kid who's like, I want to go to Harvard, or, you know, I want to go to UVM, or things like that.
Yeah, it is. It's also important to note that we hear a lot about in this narrative about the high cost of college, and I'm not going to say it's not high, those bills are daunting, but we have to also have some perspective. Every college does not cost $60,000 tuition, room, and board the way it might at a school like Harvard, and that's only a very small percentage of the colleges. 80% of the students in the country go to public colleges, and I was just looking back at the rates for tuition rates for public college tuitions around the country. The average for tuition and fee is $9,400. It's much higher, actually, in your listening area, in New Hampshire and Vermont and Massachusetts. But it's, you know, there it's almost double that. But nationally, the number is a lot lower as the average rate.
So 80% of students, Goldie, go to public colleges where it's a lot less expensive than those sort of high sticker prices that we're used to hearing about.
Yeah, I've seen some great statistics about how this, if you read some of the newspapers, you would think all the students in the country kind of go to these very pricey colleges, and you know, certainly families want to send their children to those colleges too. But Yes, between community colleges and four-year colleges, it's at least 80%.
Okay, Brennan, go ahead, jump in.
Right, and the conversation so often centers on the extremes, right? So there's Harvard, and in fact, you know, students who can't afford, who are admitted to Harvard and some of the Ivy League schools, are fully packaged most often if they can't afford it,
which means that they're getting financial aid, right?
Right, they're getting financial aid if they need it, and then so we're talking about those schools, and we're talking about community colleges and public institutions, but there's that whole chunk of schools in the middle that I think is where families struggle the most.
Jump in on this if you could, Rich. Just the idea of how families sort this out. You know, you want your kid to sort of have his or her hopes and dreams, but then sometimes you got to throw a cold bucket of water on those hopes and dreams and say no, they're too expensive.
Sure. Kind of piggybacking on what Brennan said, you know, there's a lot of people do take that approach. They pick out everything that they wanted to have, and then they go, and then they focus in on a couple schools, and maybe those schools are not going to fit the profile of what they can afford. What I try to counsel families on when I was meeting with families is that it's important to understand what questions you should be asking when you're talking to schools and starting that initial phase of what schools are going to start targeting. I'll use an example. So I went down to a school, and a bunch of people in their information session, and a parent asked, what's your highest scholarship or something like that? And I think they said it was like $30,000. And you hear all the families like, whoa. And they start looking at their sons and daughters, nodding their heads like,
this is
yeah,
good, right?
That's us. Because like, I believe my kid is that one. And no one kind of followed up on it. And so I was there as a college counselor, and I raised my hand and I said, what percentage of your accepted students get that scholarship? And it was like 15%. It was way, way low. And then the families were like, oh. So I said, beyond that scholarship, do you do any other sort of merit-based aid? No, that's the only scholarship program that we offer. Everything else is need-based. So if you're sitting there in that room, what you need to start thinking about is my kid going to be in the top 15% of people that gets admitted to this school and they get that? Or am I someone that they might be top 50%, but my family does pretty well financially and everything else is based on financial needs, so I'm going to end up paying the freight to go to this school. And they have to start thinking about how do we assess what schools are merit-based versus need-based in terms of their priority of how they're going to fund students.
Go ahead, Brennan, then Nicole, we have another question.
And
for
likewise,
you.
When it comes to just need-based aid, they need to be asking the same questions, right? I mean, they need to be asking, instead of just hearing the number, oh, well, you know, 66% of our students have a need-based aid package. They need to be asking, well, what percentage of a family's need is being met fully, right? Mm. So how much of that is grant money, how much of that is loans? Right. So they really need to dig in and find these answers out on the front end.
You know, as we talk about the high cost of college, and all of you mentioned, you know, the sticker prices isn't what a lot of people are paying, especially at some of those public colleges. I wonder, Goldie, do some kids, especially on the lower end of the income spectrum, hear about those shocking sticker prices, hear about tuition going up and up and up, and just throw up their hands and say, you know, I'm not going to bother?
It's a really huge problem in many high schools and across the country in getting students to understand that, yes, college can be very affordable for them. There are instances of some colleges where the colleges are not meeting the full financial needs of the students, but in many cases they are. I saw some number the other day. I think it's roughly like 25 to 30% of students are paying the sticker price. Most everybody else is getting some form of financial aid, whether it's and that's just paying the sticker price. That's not counting like the government grants and the like. Everybody else is getting some kind of aid from their college, whether it's need-based aid or not need-based aid. But a lot of, you know, particularly from poor families, the students don't know that. They're not in that, you know, they're not necessarily in those networks where they hear about that stuff unless they're lucky enough to get a good counselor who can let them know that this kind of aid's available, that there's federal aid available, and that a lot of schools are providing aid as well.
Now, say a little bit more about that, Goldie, if you could, please. They're not necessarily in those networks where they would know that, yeah, you might get a lot of help and be able to afford it.
Yeah, there's this phrase out there, they call it college knowledge. And if you're from a middle-class family and one of your parents or both your parents went to college, you kind of know about this. Your family, friends, you're in a sort of network of people who went to college. For a lot of students in our country, first-generation students, students from lower-income neighborhoods where their families are not in these sort of professional jobs, they can be really talented students, and they're not hearing about this in their day-to-day life. It's not part of what do they call that, the social capital. It's not part of the discussion around the family dinner table in quite the same way. And so they rely on their school counselors or organizations like Abbott or College Bound or groups like that. If they're lucky enough to get into one of those groups, they get a little more advice. But, in a lot of these high schools, the ratio of counselor to student is something like 300 to 400 to 1. And those students are not getting the kind of detailed college advice that other, middle-class and upper-middle-class students are getting.
College knowledge. I love that, Goldie. Brennan, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real issue. I mean, we at Derryfield, we have the Breakthrough Manchester program, which works with underserved students from the Manchester Public Schools starting in middle school. And a lot of the students are first generation, are low-income students who just don't have access and don't have the it's just not part of the conversation. It's not part of the dinner table conversation. It's just it's not part of the culture.
It must be heartening, Rich, for some of these young people to hear, oh, it's not out of my reach. I wonder what NEEF is doing to sort of spread that college knowledge.
Yeah, so as an organization, as a nonprofit, NEEF does programming at, as of last year, 100% of the public high schools in New Hampshire. So if a school is hosting a financial aid night, more often than not, we are the presenting organization that is presenting on the financial aid process and the paying for college process. But in addition to those school programs, our offices in Concord are open Monday through Friday for people to schedule appointments to do college planning, file financial aid paperwork, go over funding options, and all that's for free. We just ask that they schedule an appointment so that we don't have a line out the door. But yeah.
The exchange phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'd love your questions and comments this hour on going to college without going deep into debt. And while the cost of higher education is high, as we're hearing, it maybe isn't as high as you think. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. With us in studio, Brennan Barnard, Director of College Counseling at Derryfield. He also writes on college admissions for the Washington Post, the Huffington Post, and the Concord Monitor. Goldie Blumenstick joins us from D.C., senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. And Rich Nielsen is here, Education Loan Program Manager with the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation, as he said, known as the NEEF Network. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. So, Rich, to you first, but I want to hear from everybody. How hard is it to assess what you can and can't afford, given that, each school is different, each one has a different aid package, each one has a different loan package? I mean, how do you even begin to understand what you can and can't afford when you don't know how much aid you might get?
Yeah, it's very difficult to get a really detailed answer for that. The federal government tried to address that issue by requiring all institutions to have what's called a net price calculator available on their website. And the net price calculator is supposed to be used as a tool to kind of prior to at any point, you don't have to apply or anything. You just go to their website, plug in some data points, and it's going to say, this is an estimated financial aid package, things that you could receive. And there are minimum data points that a school would have to report back. And then a school could go all out and show you everything that you could possibly get by asking a lot more questions, depending on how customized they wanted to do it. So what I have found through looking at a bunch of these is that some of them are really great and give a really good assessment. And some of them are, wow, you're not telling me much other than what federal aid I might get. You're not telling me anything about institutional aid or anything like that. But it was a step in the right direction. There's also been some work to try to push for a standardized award letter so that families aren't getting confused by different schools, the way that they outline what you're receiving for aid. And so there's been a push on that front so that no matter what schools you're applying to, every time a school offers you some sort of financial aid package, it's going to look the same. That hasn't been adopted by every institution yet. It's not a law, but there are a number of institutions that are moving in that direction.
Well, and Goldie,
comes,
yeah.
That also would come after you've already been applied and
sure.
got it accepted. You wouldn't see that. The other, he's right about the net price calculators. They are only as good as every school wants them to make. Each school wants them to be on their site. There's some information on the new tool that the Education Department created, the College Scorecard, where you could look up, roughly by your family income. I think they have it in three or four categories of income. What typical aid is for students at that college? When you're making your first cut at looking at schools and what kinds of financial aid packages they have, that would be a place to look as well.
So sounds confusing, Brennan.
Yeah, and there is the scorecard. I think the scorecard can be deceptive to some families. It's a great beginning tool, but I think as they get farther and farther into the depths of it, I think some of those numbers can be a little deceiving. The other thing is more and more colleges are starting to offer early reads on financial aid, especially when athletics is involved and other things like that, where you can kind of fill out some forms for the financial aid office and they'll give you a sense, especially if a student is maybe applying early decision or something like that, and they'll give the family a sense. This is a ballpark of what you are likely to receive. And so, families should ask about that when they go to colleges. Are they willing to do that?
So, Brennan, help me out with this. So initially you and others said, hey, students, know what you can afford before you begin that search. But now it seems like you guys are saying you can't really know if you can afford a particular college until you talk to that college and see what they have for you.
Well, I think it's more about know what your family is going to be able to contribute towards college. And are finances going to be an issue in determining your college choice? And so that's the upfront conversation that families need to have early on in high school.
The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Going to college without going into huge debt. That's our topic today in The Exchange. Again, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And first up from Henniker is Alyssa. Go ahead, Alyssa. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to ask about the option of going overseas to an English language institution for college. Some of the colleges or universities in the UK are about half the price of the ones in the United States. There are English language programs in Germany and the Netherlands, and I just wanted to ask some of your panel's recommendations on that.
Yeah, Alyssa, it's a great question. And Brennan, actually, my nephew is going to college in Canada and paying a lot less than he would
say,
in this country.
You don't even have to go overseas. You can just go right over the border. There are tons of great schools in Canada. We have students go to schools in Canada every year. I've in the last 2 years, I've been to both Ireland and Scotland on college visits, and there's some amazing opportunities there. And even with the travel back and forth, it's still much more affordable. And, I mean, St. Andrews in Scotland, University in Edinburgh, there's just amazing opportunities.
So, go ahead, Goldie.
In Ireland and in England for work, and I met with a lot of college presidents from both countries, and I can tell you they're very eager to have American students.
They sure
really?
Are.
Really? So, Goldie, they don't jack up the price for Americans like we, in this country we have in-state tuition and out-of-state tuition. There's a big difference.
Oh, they jack up the price, but it's still it's still more affordable.
Really? Wow. Rich, go ahead.
One thing I would say about any time you're going to go to an international school, so a number of those international schools will still be eligible for Title IV funding, which is what's going to deem you eligible for things like federal loans, federal parent loans, and things like that are going to help you pay that price. Because, for example, as you're saying, they still keep the price is high, but relative to what it costs here in the States. Find out if the schools that you're looking at are Title IV approved, because you'll have more options for funding if they are.
Wow. Should have gone to school in Ireland. Who knew?
No kidding.
All right. Well, coming up, more of your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, navigating how to pay for college. We're looking at different resources. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Brennan Barnard, Goldie Blumenstick, Rich Nielsen, right back to our listeners. Carol's in Holderness. Hi, Carol. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Go ahead, Carol.
Alternative way to fund college is through a trustee program. I went through college, and you get full tuition.
Yeah, and Carol, your phone is breaking up, but I think I heard you say ROTC programs. Rich, can you help us out on that one?
So ROTC.
Reserve Officer Training Corps.
Yep. There's different branches of the military that offer those programs. You'd have to check. Not every school, like a school can have an ROTC program. It might be specific for Army. It might be specific for Navy. It may not be for all of them. They might have all of them. And there's no guarantee that if you do ROTC, you're going to qualify for that scholarship. So you can still do ROTC, but not necessarily get the scholarship. But it is a way that you could potentially, you have to apply for it. And what I would say, while not knowing all the details of all the programs, I do know that if you want to be considered for that program, say going in as a freshman, you need to start looking at that far in advance because it's a long process to be admitted and to get into that scholarship process. So I would say you need to start looking at it early junior year of high school in terms of what the requirements are going to be so that you can get things done by the deadlines that they set, because it's going to follow a different pattern than just applying to college in that typical schedule.
Carol, thanks a lot for the phone call. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. I wanted to get you guys to define something for me because it's a little tricky. It sounds great. Goldie Blumenstick, need-blind admission. What is that and how common is it really?
Need-blind admissions means they're making a pure admissions decision on you. You're getting admitted whether or not your whatever your financial need is. They're not going to take your financial need into account when they admit you, but it may or may not come with a guarantee that they're going to then meet that financial need later on.
So they don't look at your finances, Goldie, when they admit you, but that doesn't necessarily mean they say, okay, Laura, you're wonderful, we want you. That doesn't necessarily going to say, and we're going to give you everything you need to help afford this.
Right. I mean, obviously, the greatest opportunity is a school that is need-blind in admissions and also guarantees to meet full need. But only the wealthiest schools can make that kind of guarantee.
And need-sensitive, Goldie, what is that?
I can't play that one as well.
Go ahead, Brennan.
So need-sensitive or need-aware are schools that they might initially review your application without thinking about need, but then as they get into the final stages of decisions and who they're going to take in their class, they are aware of what you need. It does come into the decision as they try to balance out the class and be able to fund folks.
Doesn't that kind of go against the American meritocracy, Brennan, that, you know, if I'm a great student, you should take me no matter how rich or poor I am?
Right. But the colleges could take, a full class of great students regardless of what they need and then not be able to fund them all. It's this balance between do you accept a student – and then they can only afford, $5,000 of $60,000, and you leave them with $55,000 in debt. So you're saying, we'd love to have you, but, you'll have to pay $55,000 a year. And that's, some schools think that's not a good way to go.
Do you want to jump in on that, Rich? Need blind, need sensitive, need aware.
Yeah. It's good to ask. And as Brennan said, when you're talking about schools that are need sensitive and need aware, it's when you're really getting down to the final cuts. Might be who are we going to take off the wait list or something like that. It's not something where straight off the bat we're looking at everyone's finances before we admit anyone. It's typically, it might be a decision. No, we've got these 10 kids and academically they're all very similar. But do we offer admissions to these three when the likelihood that they're going to accept that offer because of what we're going to ask them to pay is going to be less than what these people are? I mean, there could be different factors. It could be that they're, whatever it is, you know, it might be that they're, you know, they're rounding out their class. They're like, you know, we would like to get more of a lower income population into our school. And, you know, we will be fully funding these people. And
they want
these other people
community.
We're not going to. So we are looking at the, you know, I don't work for those colleges, so I can't say exactly what's in their head. But,
And it's a double-edged sword for the colleges. They also sometimes get criticized for admitting students who can't afford it. And, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, whether they're allocating their aid in the right places. I mean, it's a bigger issue if you have a lot of merit aid and you're awarding financial aid to students who don't have the financial need, but then you're not giving financial aid to students who do have that need. Then, you know, that raises a whole different set of ethical questions, I think.
So, Goldie, you're saying colleges kind of, they're in a no-win situation. They want to admit kids from a variety of backgrounds, but then when that requires some of them to go into debt, they also get hit for saying, why did you saddle this poor kid with so much debt?
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's completely a no-win situation for them. Some of us do this deliberately. They allocate some of their financial aid budgets to students who are maybe have more resources, you know, but are better students because they want to make their profile look better in one of the rating systems or something too. Unfortunately, there's quite a bit of gamesmanship that goes on among a very small subset of colleges, generally the private colleges. That are a little bit more selective.
Yeah, and Brennan, you've written a lot about the murky world of the admissions process, but go ahead.
And often schools will use merit scholarships to draw in students who might not have full need.
Again, merit means you're a great student or you're a great athlete or you're a great musician.
Right. You have great test scores, you have great grades. But they'll often do that to attract students who maybe are above their profile. Who can afford it, and so they're offering them smaller scholarships to draw them in, and then those students are going to pay the rest of the boat, and that's going to help some of the students who can't afford it. So it's a real balance. It's a fine line as they sit down and try to craft a class.
Oh, do you want to jump in, Rich?
Yeah, sure. And it's certainly not for me to say what is right and what is wrong for a college to do. But being that is the world that we currently live in, and that's how colleges are doing it, going back to those, what are the sorts of questions that you need to ask, you know, asking schools, you know, are you merit-based or are you need-based? And so you have these students that might be high-achieving students, come from wealthier families. Should they be looking at, I shouldn't say wealthier families, upper-middle-class families, where maybe they're not going to get much in terms of need-based aid, but because of their high academics or other things that they're being evaluated on for a scholarship, they could do really well at a school that's offering merit-based scholarships and get much more money than what they would get at another school. And vice versa, a student that might be high-achieving but come from a lower-income family, they need to know that there are schools out there that do meet full need and that they can access those schools and be fully funded.
And not be intimidated by, again, these sticker prices that get so much attention. Yeah. There is help available, especially for low-income families. Quick, Brennan, then back to our listeners.
I'll just give you a quick snapshot. So at Derryfield, we have students from all income levels, right, in our senior class. And last year, when you average it out among the whole senior class, students were offered just over $25,000 a year in merit scholarships. So when you average it out, all the students. And so, I mean, that's students who are full need, that's students who have no need. And I mean, that's a big chunk of college tuition, right? And so there's a lot of money out there, and schools are doing a lot of different things in terms of discounting and other ways of approaching it.
Well, and Goldie, I know you and I have talked about this before. As we talk about the discounts that Brennan mentions and the aid that Rich described, here's the question I always ask. Why don't they just lower the overall price? You know, why keep mucking around with a little nip and tuck here? Just lower it overall.
There's an equity issue in that too. Frankly, you could say from the college's point of view, they're, you know, as a business person would say, they're leaving money on the table. They're letting a lot of families who could afford to pay more of what is a real cost. Let's admit they're basically discounting the tuition to those families also. And so, if you think about college as this, not necessarily as a product, but sort of this, you know, nonprofit public good, and it costs $100 to deliver the product, telling some families they're only paying $70 when they could afford to pay the $100 isn't really fair either, because they're still getting the full value of the education.
Let's go back to our listeners. Katie's in Concord. Hi, Katie. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thank you. I'm calling from the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, and this affordability of college is an issue we actively work on. We're one of the largest providers of publicly available scholarships in the state. We provide over $5 million in aid to around 1,400 students each year. But one of the issues I'd love to hear your listeners' comments on is, in addition to talking about how to reduce the tools to pay down the four-year debt, there's also different models that are quite powerful in reducing the cost of college for parents. First is just considering alternatives to a four-year degree when students are planning their path to the workforce. There's many good-paying jobs here in New Hampshire that are available to students who have a certificate, an IT certificate, for example, or a two-year degree in technical jobs in advanced manufacturing and in healthcare, for example. Students can enter the workforce in those jobs. They can, if they wish, go back later and stack additional credits to go move toward a four-year degree if that's part of their career planning. But they can actually be in the workforce earning money to help with the college cost and obviously support themselves.
So you don't have to do that traditional on-campus, 4 years, Ivy Halls, and so forth, Katie.
Absolutely. And an alternative four-year degree can still have an on-campus experience. But we have many employers in the state telling us they need students with more streamlined pathways coming in from either high school with certificates or two-year degrees, and they can use them right away in interesting, high-paying jobs. The second model that's different is for students to consider trying to earn college credit while in high school. And many schools in New Hampshire have this option. There's programs like Running Start, AP courses, where parents and students can get a much more significant return on the dollar in terms of college credit.
Now, Katie, I had heard that some colleges weren't accepting AP classes anymore because they couldn't ensure the quality of those AP classes at all the different high schools around the country.
Right. Well, I think that would depend on the college, but it's certainly it's an option for students. And the Running Start programs, in particular in New Hampshire, are generally paired in partnership with a community college. So there's a guarantee there of the community college acceptance of credit. So
okay.
It really depends on the program. But those are two different models and ways to think about college affordability.
Well, and Katie, I'm glad you called. And just following up on what you said about different models, with this email from Lisa, who says, as I am packing up my son to head to UNH tomorrow, this topic is very relevant to me. Lisa, thanks for the email. She says, I agree that parents need to have a realistic conversation with their children early on, and also recognize that not all students need to attend a traditional four-year program. When my son was younger, my dream was that he attend a four-year college, but in his junior year of high school, he made it clear that he wanted to attend a two-year forestry program. Given that UNH is upwards of $30,000 a year for in-state students, now that's tuition, room, board, and everything, because tuition is just about 16 or 17, I think. Lisa says, my husband and I support our son's choice and know that when he graduates, he'll be able to get a decent job and not end up living in our basement. Between student loans, merit-based scholarship, and family support, our son should graduate with less than $20,000 in debt, an amount that will not be overwhelming for him to pay back. So thank you for the call, Katie, and for the email, Lisa. And Goldie, I love your thoughts on this idea of, you know, let's break out of that traditional mold and see if we can do this a little differently and pay a little less.
Yeah, I think Katie and your email guest, I'm sorry I didn't catch your name, are exactly right. And, you know, the dual degree programs, where dual degree, you can take your classes at community colleges while you're still in high school and have them count towards college credit, that's really catching on a lot across the country right now. I also think if you're not the kind of student who wants to go away to college for 4 years when you're 18, taking this other route, it's pretty smart. First of all, it gives you real-world experience. I think, you know, at the end of the day, when you're, you know, at the end of your college experience, your resume is going to look a lot more interesting to an employer than it would just saying, oh, I went to college and I, you know, did what I did. I wrote for the student newspaper. I mean, I didn't look, you know, someone who took some time off, did some other interesting things, had some real-world experience while and also balancing work and school at the same time, which often is the case. I think that demonstrates a level of maturity and that the workplace will reward a lot more so than it probably has in the past. And frankly, I think the notions of how we go to college are changing so much these days that if I don't know that there ever was a stigma to that, but if there was one, I think it's fading.
What do you think about that, Brennan, the notion of how we go to college? I like the way that Goldie frames it. We're sort of breaking that open a little bit.
Yeah, we sure are. I mean, whether you're talking online education or you're talking about the competency-based education like College for America down at Southern New Hampshire, I think it's really sitting down with students and families individually one-on-one and saying, what are your hopes? What are your goals? What kind of experience do you want to have in college? Is the next stage of your life just about getting a degree? Is it about a career? What really are you looking for?
Because that's a lot to focus on when you're 17 years old.
Yeah, it's a lot to focus on when you're 42 years old.
I mean, it just, you know, I have a almost 17-year-old. I don't know if I'd get a reasonable answer out of him if I asked him those big, broad questions.
Goldie. That's one of the reasons I think Katie used the word stack, and we hear this word a lot in the higher ed, you know, policy world these days, stack and stackable credentials. It's a really important new concept that's maybe not so new, but it's being better understood these days. You know, you start with something and then it builds into something else. So maybe you're the kind of a student who, you know, you don't really have to know, but you could explore with a certificate program or at a community college, and then that sort of counts towards an associate's degree, and then that counts towards a four-year degree. This notion of making programs stackable, that they fit, you know, one builds onto the next, is becoming a bigger and bigger focus for colleges these days.
Cool. I had not heard of that, Goldie. Stackable.
Stackable stackable credentials is the term of art out there.
Wow. Go ahead, Brennan.
Yeah. And I think we're encouraging students more and more to seek out internships in the summer, during the year in high school. I'm actually working with the Greater Concord Chamber of Commerce right now and some of their members to create a database of companies that are willing to provide internships for students so they can see what they're interested in and can rule out different opportunities or interests.
Well, and Rich, here's a real nuts and bolts question for you. You know, we talked about family income and merit-based scholarships versus need-based and how colleges sort through how much money you really can put towards this or not. Are parents who set up these savings accounts when their kids are born, you know, and save over the years and don't take those nice trips, you know, in the wintertime, are they penalized in the end for doing the right thing and saving all that money?
Yeah, that's a very popular question. If they save in the proper manner, the easy answer is no.
What's the proper manner?
The proper manner would be that you're saving it in a parent's account, like a 529, a college savings fund.
Okay.
In the parent's name, because in that case, it is being assessed as a parent asset. And for financial aid purposes, that's assessed at a much lower amount than if it's saved in a child's UTMA account, savings account, something like that. The other popular thing it seemed to circle around for a while was put it in the grandparents' name and have the grandparents do it. What they didn't realize is that while that's not counted as an asset, it is treated as untaxed income on the student portion, which gets assessed even higher than what assets get assessed at. Yeah, so you have to be careful. What I say, certainly save, do it in the parents' name, assess at a low amount, and you'll be okay.
All right. A lot more coming up in just a moment, and we will find out about a special tuition break for some New England college students. You could save up to $7,000 at a public institution here in New England. So find out more in just a minute. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, going to college without going deep into debt. Let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Goldie Blumenstick is with us for the hour, senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, author of the book American Higher Education in Crisis, What Everyone Needs to Know. Brennan Barnard is here, director of college counseling for the Derryfield School. He writes on college admissions for the Washington Post, the Huffington Post, and the Concord Monitor. Also with us, Rich Nielsen, Education Loan Program Manager with the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation, known as the NEAF Network. 1-800-892-6477, again, is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. With us now on the phone is Wendy Lindsay. She's Senior Director with the New England Board of Higher Education. And Wendy, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, from what I understand, you administer a program called Tuition Break for New England students, not just New Hampshire, but all of New England. Who's eligible for this tuition break, Wendy, and who isn't?
Okay, well, the tuition break is an agreement to share programs among the public colleges and universities in the New England state. So residents of each New England state are eligible, including New Hampshire. And the basic eligibility is for programs that are not offered by the student's home state public colleges. And then they can go to a public college in another New England state and not have to pay the out-of-state tuition that they normally would be charged.
So give us an example, Wendy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, for example, with New Hampshire residents, they could go to University of Connecticut and study actuarial science.
Because that's not offered at UNH?
That's right. Or Keene or Plymouth State, too, are included in the determination of whether a program is offered in New Hampshire.
So if you want to study history, you're a Granite State student, you want to study history, that's available at UNH, so you don't get this break. But if you want to study French language instruction, I think was one of the ones that I saw somewhere else in New England, then you could get a break.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so the typical general programs are not available under this program, but New Hampshire residents are eligible for over 400 specialized programs on the undergraduate and graduate level.
Yeah, I looked at the list.
It's
a pretty long list, actually. How big a break is it, Wendy?
It's pretty significant. I mean, it varies from school to school just because in-state and out-of-state rates vary, and students pay in between the in-state and out-of-state rate. But on average, students are saving at least $7,000 on their annual tuition bill if they're going full-time.
Okay, I can hear some parents out there going, ka-ching, $7,000. I mean, that's not bad. How many New Hampshire students typically access this every year, Wendy?
2,500 or more are going out of state to public colleges in the other New England states.
So you're not eligible for the in-state tuition in Connecticut or Rhode Island or wherever you may go, but you do get, you know, a decent break. $7,000 is not just, you know, pocket change.
That's right. Yeah, so students pay a rate that's calculated based on the in-state rate. This may be, you know, more complicated than it needs to be, but it's usually 1.5 times the in-state rate, sometimes a little higher.
What's the philosophy behind this, Wendy?
Well, it actually goes back to the 50s. The states formed an agreement called the Compact and realized that they didn't offer all the programs that their residents may wish to pursue, so they agreed to join together and establish this cooperative program. So the idea was that it would increase access for students with affordable programs and also enable the states to share resources and not have to duplicate programs that are already offered in the New England region.
Okay, real interesting. Wendy, anything else you think students and their families should know about this program?
I will say that it's very simple to apply. We have a list of all the eligible programs on our website, and once a student determines that their program of interest is offered through this program, they simply fill out the college's application for admission, and the key thing is they declare that program on their application. But there is no separate application, so it's a pretty streamlined process.
Well, the words simple and tuition break have a nice ring to them. Wendy, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. My pleasure.
That's Wendy Lindsay. Again, she administers a program called Tuition Break for New England students. She's with the New England Board of Higher Education. And before we go back to the phones, Rich, I have to ask you, I have done probably a dozen shows on college costs and affordability and so forth over the years, and I've never heard of this.
Yeah, it's one that, because not everyone is eligible for, I don't think it's talked about kind of in the mainstream, because it's not like financial aid where if you apply for financial aid, everyone's going to get federal loans. Everyone, you know, might get merit scholarships, or everyone's heard of scholarships. But this is something that's very particular to what do you want to study? Is it at your state? And is it even a program that's offered at any one of those other schools, states' schools? But it is an excellent program. I'm thinking of a scenario that I had with a student that was don't quote me on the program, but it was like a radiology, sonography, which we would typically think as like a bachelor's degree an associate's degree program at a community college. And this student wanted to go to a four-year like radiology program, and it wasn't at a four-year public institution here in New Hampshire. So she had found all these private schools around New England area that offered this four-year program. And so they were meeting with us. They're like, wow, this is so expensive. I don't know how we're going to do this. And I'm like, did you check tuition break? And they're like, what are you talking about? And so I opened up the website and found that at a public institution down in Rhode Island.
Has to be a public institution.
It has to be a public institution. There was this school that offered it. And Dad, all of a sudden, his eyes lit up. He's like, I'm like, I don't, this is like late in the ball game. I'm like, I don't know if they're still even taking applications or anything like that. He's like, I'm going to call them tomorrow and find out. And like the daughter hasn't looked at the school or anything, but just the lure of, wow, this is going to make it, because they had their financial aid packages from other schools and they're like, wow, even if we got that in that reduced price and paid everything, it would still be cheaper than what other schools are asking us to pay. And so all of a sudden he's like, we need to check this out. So it is it's a great program.
All right. Well, back to the listeners. And Peyton's joining us from Portsmouth. Hi, Peyton. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. First, I just want to say thanks. You guys just put on a great show, and it's a huge service for the state. So I just
good.
Want to say thanks. Just that's true. So we just went through this process. My son is now entering school in the fall. But when we started the process, we decided to cast a really wide net and view the entire thing as a big market, just like anything else. We're going to spend a lot of money. There's a lot of supply. There's a lot of demand. So we wanted to just view it as a market. So what we did was we applied to a lot of schools, and we segmented those between sort of reach, you know, a pretty good candidate, and then maybe on the higher end. And then you'd be surprised when the acceptance letters start coming in, a lot of them would, most of them would have merit applied to those. And in some cases, their merit might be $25,000, and in some cases, it might be $2,500. I think it would depend on how much the school really wanted my son. And so our strategy was apply to a lot of places, see where he fit, and then how much merit they would grant us, and that made a big difference.
Define a lot, Peyton, like 10, 20, 30?
You know, the first acceptance letter we received was like $25,000, and we said, holy cow, who imagined that? And then the next was, you know, 5,000, and then the next was 2,500, and then there were a couple of denials in there.
No, Peyton, I guess what I was trying to say was how many, you said you applied to a lot of colleges, how many?
We filled up our Common App, so we did 20.
20
so
colleges, wow.
We said, you know, it's $50 or $75 to apply, but that's short money on the front end of this, and depends, you know, if you get $5,000 of additional merit, it's worth it. And then the other thing that we did, which is, I think a lot of folks are starting to do, is you then have a bucket of choices, and you have merit assigned, and then you contact the other schools and you say, hey, you know, my son has other options.
Can you help me out next year, Peyton?
and in almost all cases, they raise the merit. And in a lot of cases, you need to think that they're raising that across all 4 years. So that they might give you an additional $3,000, and that's really $12,000 over 4 years. So,
well, they're not always raising it over 4 years, though. That's one issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Sometimes they will do it for one, but the ability to go back and basically renegotiate up front to say, hey, and in a lot of cases, the school would pick up the phone and call us right away, and we would have a conversation. And in others, they would send us an email. And we started that with an email. But, you know, in most cases, we had a response, and it depends on how much they would want my son. But, you know, I guess the idea is we cast a pretty broad net.
Sure,
and
you treat it like, you know, I'm a valuable customer, and, you know, you need to deal with me. Goldie, what do you think? Good for him for driving a hard bargain.
I have, like, a bunch of reactions. At one level, I'm thinking he's the college's, like, worst nightmare.
I want him working
also,
for me.
It's kind of the epitome of college knowledge, right? This is somebody who's coming to this with a, you know, with a whole family of a lot of sophistication about it. I think at the end of the day, every college looked at that that application and saw this is what the family can afford. And so what the colleges were doing from their end was figuring out how much do we have to offer this family in order for them to come and pay the rest. So they were looking at it as a calculation also. But the key word that Peyton said was that word fit, and I think we need to get back to that a little bit more. It sounds like his son was open-minded about where he was going to go to school, didn't necessarily fall in love with the first, you know, fall in love with the most expensive school right off the bat. But at the end of the day, fit is really what matters. There's a lot of very good choices of colleges out there for students, and people, if you think more about fit, you know, that's really what should be driving this decision.
Brennan, you've written a lot about that, too. Don't just, you know, look at the shiny and lovely. Look at all the different choices out there.
Right, and I've actually tried to steer away from actually the idea of fit. Because I think for a lot of students that can be pretty overwhelming, this idea of I need to find something that fits me. And when they have a developing sense of who they are, this idea of fit can be really stifling. And so we're trying to kind of think about it more in terms of the experience they want to have, rather than, you know, this kind of glove, this one size fits all, or,
right,
you know.
It's the definition of fit that needs
right,
to change.
Right, yeah. Right, right. Yeah. And I do want to just also talk about the 20 schools.
That seems like a lot, but
it is
I
a lot.
Know.
And I think, I mean, I think that's where the folks at NEEF come in, and college counselors and folks in my profession, where, you know, we work with, I mean, the average student we have applies to 7 to 8 colleges, right? And so we work with them on the front end. Discuss that idea of the experience they want to have, or the, you know, quote unquote fit, and based on our experience, we can say, you know, you're probably likely to get a pretty huge merit scholarship at this school.
$25,000 is a lot.
It's a lot, but
about.
It's out there. I mean, we have students offered a lot more than that. I mean, it's amazing, but I think there's planning that can be done on the front end so that we don't have, you know, every student in the country applying to 20 colleges.
Let's take another call. This is Mike in Lee. Hi, Mike. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you for letting me on the show.
Sure.
I'd like to point out that there's an issue for graduate school as well as for undergraduate. My daughter-in-law went to Franklin Pierce Law School. And, you know, at age 21, she accepted $250,000 in loans. And
that's a lot for a 21-year-old.
She graduated very well, but she moved to New York, which has a different law school and a different law exam. So she has not passed the law exam yet. She's not working even as a lawyer, and she was planning on working in not a high paid, more of a public service law function in any case. So this is a person who's got a $250,000 loan with no prospect of paying it back. Her father died. Her mother is working in service industry.
Wow.
I think what's really criminal is that these loans can be given to people at a very young age, and the lenders have no skin in the game at all. They can't lose at all. So they give out these loans, and kids, I mean, this is impacting her entire life and my son's life as well, because he's married to her.
Well, Mike, I'm going to let you go just in the interest of time. I'm so glad that you called, and we could probably do a whole nother hour, folks, just on the loan industry and how these loans are given out and how people pay them back. But Goldie, I wonder what you think about Mike's comments. And Mike, thank you again.
Well, it's a very big burden. The only small bit of good news in all that is for the federal portion of those loans, which would be the grad loans that I presume she took out with the federal government, there is an option for repaying those now. It's always been there, but it's been expanded, particularly if you work in a public service field.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, you what you do is you work and you only pay, 10% of your income after I think it's 10 or 20 years. I apologize. That's a big difference, but I can't remember right offhand. Each program is a little bit different. And you pay 10% of your income for a period of time, and then the federal portion of that debt is written off. So there's one small piece of that. And frankly, you know, even if she hasn't passed the bar, if she's working in a public service, in a nonprofit or for a government or something else, those loans, that program applies.
Yeah,
there's
so
a lot of those. That's called income-based repayment, and there's a huge that's a huge part of the way a lot of students are now paying off their student loans. The government has been trying to push that a lot. It doesn't apply, however, to the private loans that obviously she took out as well.
Yeah, and that's a difference, isn't it? I'm glad you made that distinction, because private lenders have different standards and rules than public lenders like the government. Go ahead, Rich.
I just want to offer some clarifying. So the program, so if they're federal loans, the 10% would be if she was to get into the revised pay-as-you-earn program that just rolled out in December. Only certain federal loans are eligible for that. So depending on what her federal loans are now, she might need to refinance those with the federal government to get them into that program. And then whatever the remaining balance is after, I believe it's 20 years of repayment, is forgiven with a cap of 10% of your discretionary income.
Forgiven sounds nice.
Forgiven is nice. That's after 20 years of paying. Assuming that you've made 20 years of eligible payments.
Mm.
And then the public service piece that she mentioned, so that's a component. You'd make 120 qualifying payments under an income-driven plan, And then if you're during that time have been working at least full time at a nonprofit or public service industry or job, then they would forgive whatever's remaining after your 120 qualifying payments.
Well, Mike, thank you for calling. And, you know, Brennan, last question for you, sort of feeding into what Mike was talking about. What policy changes would you like to see to help students, you know, manage this?
Yeah, you know, Laura, I think we have this real opportunity as a state to create incentive programs where along those lines, where, you know, we kind of in a way we kind of kill two birds with one stone, where students, if they commit to working in New Hampshire for a number of years, right, we have this Stay Work Play initiative. If they commit to working here, that they get subsidized loans or grants from the state. And it keeps students in the state. And, you know, maybe it comes from business tax credits or who knows. But I think there's lots of opportunity for programs like that.
Dealing with the demographic challenges that we talk
exactly.
about a lot on
right.
this program.
Right.
Well, all three of you, thank you so much for being here. Goldie Blumenstick, it was great to have you again. Thanks for your time.
Thanks again for having me on.
Goldie Blumenstick, senior writer at the Chronicle for Higher Education. Rich Nielsen, good to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rich Nielsen, education loan program manager with the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation, the NEAF Network. And Brennan Barner, good to see you. Thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Brennan Barner, Director of College Counseling at Derryfield, and he writes on the college admissions process for several publications. Remember, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR.